creators of Relevant Magazine, this is the Relevant Podcast. It's Friday, August 3rd, 2018, and it's the Relevant Podcast. I'm your host, Cameron Strang, and here with me in our Orlando studios are on the ones and twos, our illustrious producer, my brother, Chandler Strang.
Hello.
On the Skype line from Nashville, Tennessee, Tyler Huckabee.
Hey, everybody.
On Skype line from Loverland, Virginia, Jesse Carey.
Hello, hello.
And still stuck in Indianapolis, Indiana, author, podcaster, speaker, Annie F. Downs.
Good morning, gents.
Well, we have a great show in store for you today. Coming up later, Derek Minor joins us. Derek has a great new album coming out August 10th. He just released about five singles, I think, from it this week. But he came in the studio a couple weeks ago and has a phenomenal conversation coming up later. He is not only a great musician and producer, but one of the voices that you need to be listening to, especially as it relates to race relations and the church and different things. He's such a thoughtful guy and
I don't
guy.
Listen to him yet. Can you put him in a category for me? Like, who else does he make music like? What kind of what's the genre?
Hip hop. I mean,
cool.
Yeah, yeah. He's a hip hop producer and artist. He does a lot of stuff with Lecrae and Andy Mineo and all those guys. And
beautiful.
Yeah, he's a good one.
Well, the other thing, but real quick, I'm kind of nervous about another segment we have coming up today because I feel like today we have Listener of the Week coming up. And if people haven't listened to last week's, it almost was good enough to retire the segment and have a walk-off. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, just watch it fly out of the stadium, trot around the bases, and that's it. Game over, lights out, go home.
Jesse, the funniest thing about last week's, I mean, people heard an edited version of the conversation. I mean, that's just how it is. Because, you know, maybe sometimes the guest is a little nervous, and we just kind of clean it up, you know? So, but listening to it, it really was a special moment on the show.
It
was so unexpected because I thought that we had the fact already.
Yeah.
You know, and then out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Drops the bomb.
Yeah.
He buried like five leads.
Yeah. I mean,
he gave you the bottom shelf. He told you the most boring things about himself.
Right.
And then that was enough to get him a spot on the show.
And the most boring things about himself was a life-threatening incident at a water park and a history of ventriloquism.
At a water park that his family owned.
That his parents owned.
And then we found out that his parents
owned.
And then he tweeted some photos, evidence.
Yes,
he had pictures of, well, I don't want to spoil it.
And the water park photos that he sent us confirmed everything that was in my head of a family owned Midwest water park.
Yeah. Crystallized.
You know, I was thinking about the movie. This is random, but I was thinking about the movie Forrest Gump the other day. And I was like, you know, it's so implausible that someone would have a life where they ran across the country for years, where they ran Bubba Gump Shrimp, where they're a war hero, where they were a ping pong champion, where they met the president and took a bullet. Or what? All the crazy stuff that happens in Forrest Gump's life, and I'm like, you know what? Cody makes me believe in life like Forrest Gump's can't exist because he's already the guy's probably in his 20s. I don't know how old he was, but I'm
going with like 24, I'm 25. Yeah,
no, I think he was like 28.
Oh,
and he's already
Cody,
lived several lifetimes of movie worthy experiences. Imagine circling back with that guy at like 40 and what's happened to him since then.
If he makes it to 40,
I want to watch the aim, the sharp objects. Like I need to get, we need Daniel Day-Lewis to pull him out of retirement because this guy has a narrative.
I want to see the vlog that he made for Dennis Rodman, like whatever happened to that footage.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I have a feeling it was lost. Yeah. I have a feeling literally he gave it to Rodman's team and it just went to the
YouTube.
Ether.
YouTube pulled it down. Right. It violated so many policies.
Too shocking for
Jesse,
YouTube.
There's a good reason we didn't retire Listener of the Week after last week. What's the reason? Why didn't we retire?
I mean, I feel like that's not our style. This is called the heat check, Annie. A lot of podcasts, what they do, they have a great segment. We're like, okay, that's great. We got to move on. Nope. We're going to see if we still got it. Yeah. Heat check time. This is us pulling up from half court and jacking up a tray. Let's just see what happens. Okay? It's either going to be a spectacular air ball.
But I'm here.
It's going to be a spectacular air ball or it's nothing but that. You know what? We're not even know because our back's going to be turned towards over to the basket, we're already pumping the jersey. You know, that's what's happening today.
Okay. That's what I think is going to happen. So I'm here.
That was a very intricate metaphor. People are going to need to run that back.
We loved Cody. If we thought Cody was the end of the game, we'd have quit the game. But we know it ain't the end. Well, we got plenty more.
It's called a heat check.
We got more where that comes from.
How hot are we?
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is yeah, the reality is though, I mean, we've been doing this for several months and we're like, oh, wow, that was really funny. That was really good. And then the next week, well, that was even better than the week before. Who knew? You know, like the stakes keep getting raised.
And people are figuring out the formula. Yeah. Like, I think the best thing about what happened last week is that there's now a formula of bury the lead. In your house.
There's a lot of people that are trying to find ways to have celebrities expose themselves. That's the formula. That's it's as simple as that. It's that simple, people. I don't know what's so hard.
I don't ever want to hear that story again.
Well, it's going to be archived in the Library of Congress on that episode. You know.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the podcasting room. It's real honor. Real honor.
We'll move the show along. It is time for
Slices.
All right. What do you have, Jesse?
All right. I have one that is kind of concerning because I didn't even know that something like this was necessary. I don't know if you guys saw this news. There is an organization in Boston that is like sort of like a tech think tank about like tech ethics. They're called the Future of Life Institute. And they have got a bunch of really powerful people, like the people who run the Google's DeepMind project, Elon Musk, you know, people in the field of technology that aren't just into some kind of signing some sort of novelty pledge. They've gotten all these CEOs to come together, 2,400 people who are groundbreaking innovators and entrepreneurs in the world of artificial intelligence, and had them come together and pledge not to make killer robots. They literally got these people together and say, hey, listen,
this is
we're going to get it in writing right now that you're not planning on making killer robots. So the idea is that they're foreseeing a time when artificial intelligence is so advanced that you would have machines capable of making moral and ethical decisions.
We know.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You named, you know.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. They're getting these people to science. This is no longer science fiction. It's a plausible, future reality in our lifetime where basically what you have on Terminator, which is machines that can decide to kill for military purposes, that could also decide, well, why don't we just take over humanity? That's a plausible outcome of current technical innovation, so much so that the leaders of technology companies are signing this document to say, no, don't worry, we're not going to do that. I wish they hadn't even done this document because I wouldn't even think it was like that real of a possibility that we had to.
Let me come at you with this, though. In the movies. In all the movies, nobody ever sets out to create a killer robot.
That's a robot
that can like think and feel and solve problems. And then the robot decides to become a killer robot of its own technological volition. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's no point in this. This is trying to hold back the tide with a broom.
Or the other side of it is that the evil genius who didn't sign it knows that nobody else has killer robots. He creates his own killer robots, and there's nothing stopping him. And then he dominates the world.
This is awful. I mean, that's an awful thought.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen enough Inspector Clouseau movies.
Well, I actually read something, this was a while ago, about a AI ethicist who says that the more you talk about AI ethics, that it's morally wrong to do so. Because the more you talk about it, the more information is out there on it, that the more that artificial intelligence, once they get closer to self-awareness, will be aware of the concerns and then exploit the concerns. So like this ethicist says, something like this is a terrible idea because it's drummed up so much publicity that it heightens the concerns that if you have artificial intelligence to become self-aware, they will then know, well, look, all these innovators have legitimate concerns about this. Then that's something we can exploit. There's people on the other that are saying that case too. Either outcome is terrifying, that this is actually a future reality here.
It's I hate everything about this slice. I hate it.
I think it's good that they're pledging, but it just seems like this is accelerating pretty rapidly here.
Yeah. You know? And like, do people really do what they say when they make pledges like that? Like, is that like, who's going to hold them to that?
Yeah, exactly.
Did it plant ideas or did it make them actually promise to do something?
Yeah, yeah. That's the other thing. It's like, well, the people at Google, it's like, oh, well, maybe there's a pretty good government contract in here. If this guy doesn't want us to do it. Yeah, sure. Sign away.
Jesse, do you remember back in 2010, we did a pretty big piece in the magazine looking ahead at the coming decade and, and kind of trends and kind of talked to experts and leaders in a number of fields, kind of like look down the road 10 years. And one of the ones we talked to is Nigel Cameron, who's a bioethicist and from Scotland. And he's a believer. And he was talking about the rapidity of how fast technology was about to accelerate in the area of artificial intelligence, 3D printing and stuff like that. And that the church and philosophers and ethicists, like, can't keep up. Like, they're not talking enough about the moral implications of what's about to happen. And this is in 2010, looking at the next 10 years. And he was kind of saying, like, by the time we get to 2020, this and this and this and this will be the case. And like, we will have to be wrestling with the reality of what is life. And then from a Christian context, like, if I can, 3D printing, we can print food, biomatter, we can print body parts and surgically graft them onto bodies. And those are living cells and stuff. So it's like, it's, medical field says that's miraculous. Like somebody has a missing ear or has an amputation and we can replace the ear or the nose or the arm or the whatever. And it's 3D printed. But like, at what point, like, is this, we are creating life? Like, physically, truly creating human life through artificial means, and like the spirit realm and all that, like from a Christian context, like we are not talking about not just the ethics, but like the worldview of like literally in the next 5 to 15 years, the church will have to grapple with living human creatures with artificial intelligence or that were created by man. And are those man created in the image of God or are they some sort of other thing? And the church isn't talking about this, and it's like right here staring at us, because
they talked about it at Q conference last year. It was one of the big talks, was the spiritual implications of AI. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
What did they say?
And what's the takeaway? And biomatter too.
Cut to the chase. What do we think?
The cool thing about Q is they don't give you a lot of answers. They more present the information. And so it was an expert on AI talking about what it'll look like when robots are able to make decisions on their own. Like, kind of how, like, if we ask them to do something, they can determine. Almost like, even think about the little vacuum cleaners you have in your house. That the little Roombas.
Yeah.
I'm not rich enough. I don't know. Roombas. Yeah. One of those. It is deciding what it feels and which way to go based on what it feels. Right. And so the conversation at Q is like, what do we do when robots like Jesse's slice is talking about, when robots like that are able to make their own ethical decisions? What is that going to mean for humans, and what does that mean spiritually, and what does that mean? Does that mean they have a soul? Does that mean that they have a decision maker in them that needs salvation? That kind of conversation.
Well, there's also the idea of, like, Cameron, you're talking about like artificial biology, essentially. So like printing organs, and you could imagine a time where you can augment your physical body to operate differently for whatever reason. So basically, like, if you're creating artificial bodies and things like that, like, there's a famous thought experiment like that. If you had like a boat, a big wooden ship, and you had another ship behind it that was full of lumber, and as the boat's out at sea, you took off piece of the boat and replaced it with a new piece of lumber piece by piece. At what point is it a new boat, or is it ever a new boat? If you replace it's actually made out of, like, what is the essence of a being, of a thing? And, the thought experiment is the whole point of it, is to try to make you think about that. But if you apply that to biology, and at what point are you still the creation of God and not the creation of man?
And also the ethics of, which is, I mean, obviously technology is there, of, you know, manipulating, you know, genes in the womb, you know, to like kind of designer babies and stuff. Obviously, right now there's not a cultural appetite to allow that, but it's possible. And it just takes a few people going, well, you know, ethically, we should prevent this child from having like Down syndrome or something. We can do that. Like, you know, now all of a sudden the question of, you know, made in the image of God, and God has a plan and path and purpose for that life. And, you know, like we're just tweaking it the way we want it. Like, who's playing God? And I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, it's right there. I mean, the technology exists for all this, you know, it's like, I don't know, man.
That's fascinating.
And how much, how much of your body getting replaced by 3D printed biomatter makes you human or not? Like, I mean, that's it's crazy.
I think, I mean, but it, now y'all, I'm more simple than all of you. So I am understanding that. But to me in my head, I think you can't change your brain.
Well, sure you can.
I mean, you can't trade out a brain for a computer brain. Or for a
not yet.
Yeah. But the
printed brain.
I mean, we're able at this point to manipulate brain chemistry with drugs, right? Like you can change someone's personality with drugs. That, you know what I mean? It's not that far, but
when we do that, we never question whether they're still a human or whether they're still there.
What about if you're not doing it with chemicals, but if you're doing it with nanoparticles, with artificial cells,
I want to boost my intelligence so we can actually go in there. We know what part of the brain we add cells. We do the synapse. We do this, that, whatever. They can absolutely do that. They don't, but the technology is there. I want to be more kind, or I want to this, and I can actually just craft a personality in my child in the womb or something. I want them to go in and like make sure that they're smart and compassionate and athletic.
Yeah.
You know, like you just go ahead and tweak the brain.
That does not come as a trio, by the way. Oh. You've named three things that are literally not possible.
But Annie, I think
match.com confirms.
But that's the thing. Like, cause you can already change. You can already change brain chemistry chemically. Right. Like on the chemical level, you can change. But it's like I said, the future of medicine isn't just chemistry. It's nanoparticles. It's tiny machines that your body thinks is cells that operates in a way that you can dictate. You know, like nanotechnology, I feel like a lot of people think is the wave of the
We had a listener of the week 3 weeks ago who was a nanobiologist.
Yeah.
Who was doing, you know, mind control experimentation with mice.
Yeah.
I mean,
or even like, you know, if you could inject yourself with something that it had cells that would hunt down like a cancer tumor. But that was its only task, because that's what it was literally programmed to do, because it's not a chemical. It's actually tiny machines like that. That future's here. Like that kind of thinking and the ethics behind it. It's really tough, because you could think of a lot of scenarios where it could be used for really good. And then a lot of scenarios where it's like, well, I don't really know the morality of that, you know?
And that's what Nigel Cameron was talking about back in 2010. Not only we need to be asking these questions, but he's like, throughout human history, philosophers and ethicists and religious leaders kind of, you know, in time and over ages, you know, kind of like established moral code and things like that. He's like, it is happening so fast that in the next 10 years, like, culture won't be able to keep up with what's possible and what is actually happening. And it's going to like, it's almost like the cart will get in front of the horse, you know?
Yeah.
And we've already seen this go. We just sort of had no option but to trust that Mark Zuckerberg was a basically good guy who wasn't going to do anything bad with our data.
Right.
And he did. And we didn't have any say in that. Nobody elected Mark Zuckerberg to be chief ethicist of how relationships work on the planet, but he became one. And now we're learning that came with a price tag attached to it. And that's only going to grow. That's going to become only more and more of an issue.
I mean, the good news is the price tag is $120 billion cheaper now.
And you can afford it.
But I mean, but you look even in like Europe, different EU countries have something called the right to be forgotten, where like, let's say, especially in this era where people have done things that, you know, some for good, some for, you know, that is sort of mob mentality, but things that they've done or said or that will come up and used to shame them. You know, there are already countries that are allowing people to take legal measures to have that stuff removed from the internet that doesn't exist in this country. Like we don't even know the moral questions with data, which is basically ones and zeros on physical files, much less it actually lives in a server somewhere, much less nanotechnology that manipulates biology.
Yeah. Mm. All right. What do you have, Annie?
Okay, so there is, Jesse and I have been talking about this slice because there's so many slices to it. The Daily Beast had a long form piece just come out about how an ex-cop rigged the McDonald's Monopoly game and stole millions of dollars. Have y'all heard this
yet?
Yes. No. This story is nuts.
It's an incredible. Right. Okay, when I was reading it, I'm like, this is going to be option for a movie. In a year from now, and in case you missed that item, it's going to be, hey, yeah, remember that Monopoly slice we had a year ago? It's going to be made to a movie by Netflix, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is fascinating. The FBI caught on to this one guy, this one cop, and interviewed him and realized that he had been stealing McDonald's pieces and selling them, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, but you should go read the long story because it's interesting. And I would love to hear y'all's thoughts, Tyler, yes, and Jesse, since you've read it as well. But this guy, Jacobson, it wasn't just that he was stealing for himself. He ended up being the head of a sprawling network of mobsters, psychics, strip club owners, convicts, drug traffickers, and even a family of Mormons who falsely claimed more than $24 million in cash and prizes from McDonald's just from the Monopoly.
I don't understand how did he rig it? What was
McDonald's hired a third party agency to handle the printing of the stamps. He figured out how, like, but the security behind these was insane. But again, long story short, basically Ocean's 11 types of measures where he could sneak into the factory and switch out the winning stamps for fake ones, and then use the winning stamps. You know, one of the elements of the story I thought was interesting, the second one he stole was $1 million one, and he sent it to a children's hospital. And it said, he's an interesting,
so
complicated
figure. Robin Hooding
figure.
This thing?
What's that?
He was Robin Hooding this? I mean,
he was like a Robin Hood situation, but also strip club owners.
I mean, at the start, Cameron, he didn't Robin Hood it hard. He barely Robin Hooded it.
Okay. With great power, you know, it's easy to start. You might start with like, oh, $1 million for the children's chair, $1 million for these people.
But that gets to the heart of the story is he had his justification for it was that evidently at some point between the discussions with McDonald's and this third party agency, they felt like it would be better public relations if it was American customers that won all of these prizes. So there were no Canadian winners by intention. He's saying, well, they're rigging the game, so why don't I just rig it? And that's what he did. Right. He ended up.
And then he did stuff like Cameron, where he would give away a $10,000 ticket to a friend of his in exchange for all they had to pay him $2,000 of it. And so he was making, so he would take that little tag, that instant win tag of $10,000 and give it to someone in exchange for $2,000.
And he would have got away with it if he hadn't started selling these tickets to people who ended up ratting him out.
Yeah, that's right.
A van full of wily teenagers.
But it got me thinking. It got me thinking because I love heist stuff. I love heist stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
And this is
I thought you would like this slice.
I mean, he was doing it for like years and years.
It was a long con.
Yeah.
Is it all the winners are in the same region? He was spreading it out around America.
Okay. So for a while, they were all in Fort Lauderdale. Is that right? Jacksonville. They were all in Florida and they realized that started looking scandalous. So they started shipping it out to other cities.
Or like they would find ways. So like, let's say, because his network of friends was in Jacksonville, what he would also do is like, I will send give an address of a family member that lives in another part of the country. And he would like rig people. He would tell people to sign up for like out of state area codes. And the FBI eventually caught on to all of this so that, But it went on for a really long time.
I'm shocked. I mean, he physically went into the printing press and took pieces.
So here's this.
Yeah, apparently it was like a thing. Like they had one of McDonald's over and over in the article. It talks about one of McDonald's biggest issues with the Monopoly game was employees and people on the inside stealing pieces.
Right.
And because they recognized that there were only a certain amount of winners and they would be able to see. And so, yeah, he would just take pieces from the factory.
Yeah.
Right?
So,
Jesse,
so well, that what happened initially was like whenever he had got the pieces from the so he had no alone time with the pieces except for when they were like traveling. And because the pieces had to, once they came off the press, they would be put in these certain sealed envelopes that came from another printer, like as another check. Right. So like these certain watermarked envelopes would have to go, the pieces would have to go in these watermarked envelopes before being delivered to where they're being placed. That's like a separate check. Yeah. And he was never alone with the pieces in the envelopes, right? But at one point, the printer of the envelopes accidentally, clerical error, sent him to his house, not to the workplace, a box of the watermarked envelopes, which he kept. And so he could like keep one of those in his back pocket. And he would say like when he was traveling, he would use the restroom and that's when he would make the switch. It was insane layers of like thought and manipulation at every level. Yes. For him to win, keep these McDonald's stamps. And he was a pretty smart guy. Like I said, someone basically blackmailed him and ended up turning him in.
Wow. Yeah. Crazy.
Right?
Well, there you go.
Annie with the fascinating slice.
That's a great slice. No, yeah. I'm glad you brought that. Yeah, that's a winner.
I couldn't decide. I said to Jesse this morning, I was like, I mean, is this one too weird? And he was like, I have loved this story.
Yeah, I read it over the weekend. I was like captivated by it. Like, he was like, oh, this is the greatest, you know, long form.
You gotta go read I think the whole thing is on the Daily Beast. Are they the ones who broke the story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Well, here's the other interesting facet. The trial, okay, his trial and his conviction, because they were like, you know, this story's been out there for a while, but no one's known about it. He was convicted on September 10th, 2001. So the news of the story broke the day before 9/11. And 9/11 happened and everybody forgot about the story. And it's been buried now for 19 years because obviously it's been it was in the news cycle for like the matter of hours. That's the other interesting part about this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Man.
And I mean, I love that there are still some places like the Daily Beast that are writing really interesting long form articles. And I still think that's such an art you have to craft. Yeah. Y'all do it so well in the magazine too, Jesse. Y'all write these beautiful longer things, but online it's so rare that you get long form pieces that are really enjoyable to read all the way through.
All right. What do you have, Tyler?
This came across my feed and this is, I'm anxious to hear y'all's thoughts on this. What I'm going to read you is actually just a posted job description for a pastor. I'm not going to name the church here. I'm not trying to shame anybody, but this is a church in Colorado, and I'm just going to read verbatim the post they put on churchstaffing.com for a new senior pastor. This church, name of the church, is looking for a pastor who teaches like Craig Groeschel or Andy Stanley or even a bit like Stephen Furtick. This offer is going to be nothing like any other church job post. Red flags right there. Our city is asleep because the churches are asleep. People are hungry, but the spiritual food in the churches here are without flavor or life. The pastors are beautiful people and have heart, but we need some blockbuster sermons. When you watch a sermon from Craig Groeschel, Andy Stanley, or Stephen Furtick, you feel like you were fed. Why can't we have that in a church without playing the videos from the above pastors? Here is our concept. If a worship leader can take a song from Chris Tomlin and play it just like the album, and that is 100% accepted in the church, why can't you as a pastor copy word for word a sermon from Craig Groeschel?
Oh, somebody hold me.
Go on. Sure. Add 10% of your own style to it, just like the band would. This concept would work great mixed with your own sermons about 20% of the time. Let's give blockbuster sermons to the people, proven messages or hit sermons, then add 20% of your own sermons. If you connect with the concept, send us your resume. We'd love to talk with you. That's the job posting.
Annie, I'm interested in your take because I have a take and it might be very different than yours, but your mouth is agape right
Annie's
now.
Annie's jaw is on the floor.
But to be fair, Annie you are like a preacher. So So what are your feelings about this job posting? Then I'm going to throw my hot take out there.
Yeah, I have a feeling yours are a little bit different than mine, Jesse. I think that is one of the most fascinating things I've ever heard, Tyler Huckabee. I can't imagine I am almost speechless at the idea that that is what a church would want. I agree that those three preachers they listed are incredibly gifted.
Good communicators, but, sure.
Yeah, they're great communicators. Also, they are doing the study and the life work to come up with those talks out of their own lives and out of their own study. Cameron, say something. Help
me. Our crack fact checker, Mark Jackson, just showed me he found the job listing that Tyler just wrote, and there is an extra note at the end. And it said, we have everything needed for the church except the pastor. We have a great praise team. We have funds for advertising and more. Your salary is 90% of the tithes and offerings for 1 year to sustain you, and we will pay all the bills. Years 2, 3, and 4, you will get 50% of the tithes and offerings. It's a 5-year contract.
I am so offended from top to bottom.
So,
Mark, you're really Johnny on the spot there with that.
Well done, Mark.
Okay, all right. I want to dig into this for a minute. We don't have to get too in the weeds here, but essentially what they're offering is a profit sharing model, but instead of profits, they're doing tithe sharing, right? So they're giving, it's essentially like a sales commission model, but instead of sales commissions, it's a percentage of tithe. I can see how that's problematic.
Assuming that people give in relation to how much they enjoy a sermon that they know was not actually, that is a cover sermon, basically, of somebody else's work.
So I can understand, Jesus, I can understand the problematic element of the payment, but
you're so far. I know. Go, Jesse.
Thing is like the open sourcing of the sermon, right? Because that's essentially what it is, right?
Well, it's intellectual property theft, right?
But I guess my question is this: should sermons be intellectual property? Because it's not because most intellectual property exists in the for-profit, like, you know, you're consuming media that was made with the intention of generating revenue, right? Like, I paid money to go see a movie, or a ticket to see a concert, or an ad was, you know, placed on this in exchange for payment. Is a sermon, and again, I'm not saying one way or the other, I'm just saying for the sake of the discussion, is a sermon materially different because the intention of the sermon is materially different?
I mean, my understanding, and I could be wrong, is like back in the day, like, you know, like Jonathan Edwards would preach a famous sermon, like Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God.
Yeah.
And he would, it's written, you know, they preached that way back in the 1700s, 1800s. And then he would preach that several places. Obviously, you know, modern preachers do the same thing. I mean, they'll speak at a number of conferences. Right, they do the same talk.
Yeah.
But then like, I thought like Jonathan Edwards' sermons like then got shared and distributed, and that other pastors and preachers at the fledgling churches in the colonial times like would then preach the Jonathan Edwards sermon to their little congregation because it had more theological substance than what they could have done on their own.
But if someone was like, "Hey, today this sermon, I'm preaching a Craig Rochelle sermon," and I launched into it, if they credited who, you know, came up with it, is it different than what like worship teams do?
That's significantly different to me. If you stand up and you say, "What I'm about to tell you for the next 22 minutes is what Craig Rochelle wrote and preached on July 5th, 2017." That is, I don't think it's a good idea. I actually think it's a terrible idea.
But yeah, at least it's ethical.
But I think that I can hear that more than just assuming what you're hearing is
me. Yeah.
Take it. And the tithing part. Yeah. That
is the tithing though? Part. Seems
that is going to get you. Listen, dear church in Colorado, I love you. And I think highly of the local church. I think it's the hope of the world. You're going to get struck by lightning. That is not how tithing goes. That is not what God...
90%.
I'm going to get struck by lightning, but that's not what God intends. I'm like about to stand up out of my chair. Do y'all see me? I can't even stay seated.
I'm glad you're on board. That's fiery.
The crazy thing to me is we're asking you to not work during the week because you've got the sermons already written for you, but you're going to get 90% of the tithes. Like, I don't understand...
That is a performer. What they are saying is, we want to see how much of your performance gets tips.
Yeah.
Well,
that's what they're wanting. Yeah.
It's a commission-based salary structure.
I don't know. I don't want to give too much away for the next issue, but we have an interview with Francis Chan in the upcoming issue of the magazine that I feel like a lot of, that is very challenging.
Really addresses this.
Yeah, and he makes a case for... I'm just trying to think of the right word, for like non-vocational ministry, that people
non-vocational,
there are no such things who are not paid. Like, he's not saying you shouldn't have professional pastors, but he said there should also be non-professional pastors.
Yeah, he just said, like, if we want to look at the actual biblical model of the church, I mean, again, that was a very different culture and, you know, time, obviously, but
which is how I feel about your Jonathan Edwards thoughts.
That's right. No, I wasn't. Hey, I'm not advocating. I was just saying, you know, devil's advocate.
Need to quit advocating for that.
But if someone credited it, though, it's
no. I think it's sloppy and just that's dumb. But Francis Chan was saying, like, you know, if you look at the biblical model of the church, it was small gatherings, met in homes, 10, 12 people. And the people who led the gatherings weren't like professional pastors. So they worked like anybody else. And so he talks about his faith community that he's in now, that they do that none of the pastors are paid. And that if a gathering gets more than 12 people, they split off to another one.
So. Okay. Can I say one more thing? Thing about this.
Yeah.
Here's what is true. I am super involved in the teaching team at my local church. I also travel and speak at other churches on Sunday mornings frequently. So I see both sides of that world. Here's what is true. Your local church, what they need on Sunday is not necessarily what Craig Groeschel preached last Sunday.
Yeah.
What most pastors are doing really well and really beautifully is they know their community and they are preaching what their community needs. It does not need to be a performance. It does not need to be the very best talk they've ever heard. It needs to be what the community in your town needs to go out and share Jesus with their neighbors that will then bring their neighbors into that church. Forget the tithing. Forget the recorded other sermons and you're copying them. And even forget the Chris Tomlin songs. Do what your community needs. Do what your church family needs to see and experience Jesus in the community you live in. And that will change things. And that will change your community. And then your preacher will be great because the Holy Spirit will be doing what the Holy Spirit needs to do in your community. Good night.
The awkward part about it is, like, let's say someone does it. The personal anecdotes in the sermons, because that's what makes a lot of those guys like stand out, you know? So it's like, so listen, I was at Craig Groeschel's kids' baseball game. Just stick with me here. Something really powerful happened.
Exactly. Also, this Colorado church is probably literally doing what they think is a really good idea.
Yeah.
Like no one sat down and thought they're not being schemers. A community decided this was the right idea. A committee decided it was the right idea. It's just not. So they're wrong. But so, I support them for trying.
It's crazy. And then you look at the worship parallel and it's not, I mean, it's crazy. I'm not on board with this at all.
Yeah, but music has always been shared across churches too.
Yeah,
hymnals exist.
I guess my thing is, like, what's the difference?
Well, there aren't personal anecdotes in songs for starters.
For some. I mean, I'm playing the devil's advocate here for a bit, I feel like a lot of songs that are written are based on people's personal experiences. I mean, you talk to a lot of worship leaders and be like, I mean, like, you talk to, you know, Corey Asbury with Reckless Love, you know, it came out of experience.
But people write songs intending them to be corporately with the understanding that these are going to be shared.
To the early church and then hymns and stuff. I mean, like, there was a song written that then spread throughout the Big C church, you know, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. There is a parallel, absolutely, but there is a historical precedent that churches share, you know, participant congregational worship that is more global, you know, or national.
Yes, the teaching and the worship are two very different things on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
It is okay. So the other person on the stage on most Sunday mornings is the person doing the announcements. Why in the world would I do the hosting at Crosspoint the exact same way that Craig Groeschel's person who does the hosting does it on Sunday morning? Why in the world would I make the exact same announcements they make? It's different because we're two different communities. We have different announcements we need than a church in Oklahoma or a church in Colorado. So they need different sermons too. I got to stop.
Yeah. Do you think it's ever appropriate? Like, let's say there was a sermon that, like, let's say there's a national issue, right? that it's like the church needs to address this. And somebody at some church that was a pastor didn't just a sermon that's like, you know what? That was awesome. That was exactly that spoke to this time. Would that be appropriate?
And I think there are maybe I think there are denominations that people start with similar outlines, or they're all going to use the same scriptures. And I know there's a church in Nashville that they each campus has a different preacher every Sunday, but they kind of build the outline together. Yeah. I think that's really, really different than 80% of your sermons being listening to other pastors, taking that message and bringing it in. But yeah, Jesse, I can see a national conversation that happens and someone preaches down a line that's really beautiful and helpful. And nationally we go, okay, I'm going to take that little piece of that and tell you why that's true. But here's why that's true for our family and for our house and our community.
There you go. Localize it. Okay. All right. Well, that'll do it for Slices. Stay tuned. Up next, Derek Miner joins us.
I was right in the middle of a job application. What were you saying, Cameron? I just got finished with one part. 90% of the time.
Fuck,
right.
You got me so heated, bud.
They don't say how big the church is. It might be six people, but you know.
Yeah, but you get 90% of the tithe, so I hope you can live off of $48.
I'm done with building these castles that crumble like sand. Oh, knees on the floor, I finally found it. Everything I need.
Listening to Till I Found You by Phil Wickham. His new album, Living Hope, releases today. Go get it. At the beginning of the podcast, you heard Maggie Rogers, a former Relevant cover artist, with her new single, Give a Little. This week's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website. I've been using Squarespace for years, long before they sponsored the show, and it is so easy to make a great website. When you sign up for a year of Squarespace, you'll receive a custom domain for free. You can even design a best-in-class online store with Squarespace's award-winning templates, customizable settings, and more, all without a single plugin. For the store, they include all the tools you need to even track inventory, process orders, and send custom emails with one intuitive interface. It's called Squarespace Commerce and allows you to understand every aspect of your business. Well, right now, Squarespace is offering Relevant podcast listeners a special deal. You can go to squarespace.com/relevant for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch your site, use the offer code RELEVANT to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. We love it when you guys tell us that you do that. I mean, countless websites have been built using the promo code RELEVANT. It's awesome. I've used the promo code RELEVANT to save 10% on Squarespace sites. Squarespace, set your website apart. Rapper Derek Miner recently stopped by the new Relevant studio for a wide-ranging conversation about the state of Christian hip-hop, the importance of addressing social issues in his music, and why he doesn't feel the need to play it safe, even as a Christian artist. He's also just released 5 new singles off his upcoming album, The Trap, which is available for pre-order now. It'll release August 10th. Here is our conversation with Derek Miner.
Welcome to the revolution. Welcome to the revolution. They've been looking for the blueprint. You can get it here exclusive. Welcome to the revolution. They've been looking for the blueprint. You can get it here exclusive.
What I want to know is, in the last 2 to 3 years of hip hop, from the faith perspective, what trends have you noticed? What changes have you noticed in the past maybe 2-3 years?
That's interesting. I don't see any trends. I think that's the crazy part. It's about with music in general, there's no rules. I think everybody's just trying to figure it out. It's like, what do? Do you drop 4 or 7 song projects in a month like Kanye?
Yeah.
Or do you do a double disc album like Drake? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I think everyone has figured out that content is key, but how do you deliver the content? Is, you know, no one really knows. So You know, you got major labels stepping in now. They're trying to figure it out. But, you know, I think right now this is, but that's a, it's the perfect time. If you're a Christian that wants to do art, like, this is the perfect time to get in because no one knows what they're doing. Everyone's just trying to figure it out. So if you figure it out, then, you know, I mean, you're the man, you know. So for us, we're just experimenting, man.
I just want to see you win. We can't take no L's this year, nah, it's not in the plan. You don't understand, I just want to see you win. If they ain't with the squad, then just leave them in the stands. You don't understand, I just want to see you win. We just take our hustle and on top is where we land. We don't understand, I just want to see you win.
With RMG, us being indies, that allows us to have a degree of flexibility that and take more risks than, you know, certain others.
Yeah.
You know, aren't able to do. We can just say, I can say, all right, we'll do 4 projects in a year. Or I can say, oh, I'm just going to do 1 long. It doesn't matter, you know. There's no rules. You know, everyone is trying to figure it out. You know, for me, I've been on this journey of a 4-project series. So the first one I dropped in September was just So Must Fly. The second one I dropped was High Above. And then coming in August, I'm dropping a project called The Trap, August 10th. And then By Any Means drops sometime in the year. And originally I was gonna do it every month, but then I was like, you know what? I'm gonna spread it out a little bit more and let it breathe. So that's some of the risk though. I think that was kinda, I was one of the first guys to really start saying, I'm gonna do the series thing.
Yeah.
And then now more people are doing that because they're trying to, everyone's trying to, you know, figure out what's the best way to deliver content to people and what's digestible.
Of course, I ain't gotta worry about a thing anymore. I just, yeah, of course, with a kind of thorns, feeling like a king. Yeah, of course, made it out the bottom. Of course, I ain't gotta worry about a thing anymore. I just,
yeah. Christian music has always been sort of like a retirement home for music, I think. And what I mean by that is,
yeah.
When you look at any other market, most other products, you know, toothpaste, coffee, beer, cigarettes, whatever, I want to get you when you're 16, 17, 18, thinking about our product, and then I grab you then, and then I have you for the rest of my life. Right. Christian music is different. Their model is built around marketing to a 40, 50-year-old soccer mom. And so they're like, hey, after you've done all of that, had all your fun or whatever, then whenever you need music to play in a car that's safe for your kids, then you can listen to us. Like, that's been the strategy for the past, you know, 40, 50 years. Here's the problem now. The problem is music is a tech industry now and it's individualized now. So now mom's playlist and son's playlist on Spotify is totally different.
Right.
And now kids aren't forced to sit in the car and listen to what mom likes because we all have our earphones. We have a Spotify or Apple Music family plan.
Right.
And now the kids, you know, they're listening to what they want to listen to and the parents are listening to what they want to listen to. So that means in the past, Christian's whole thing was, well, we're the safe version of this, safe version of that. And there was a little bit of pressure for the kids to kind of have to conform to that. But now since everyone's in their own earpods, the kids just listen to what they want to listen to.
Right.
So now that kind of strategy that really has sustained Christian music for the past, you know, 30, 40 years, it's not really viable anymore.
Right.
You have to compete, actually. And I think that's causing a recession in this space.
Okay.
On top of with America becoming more and more post-Christian or more liberal in a sense, not really conservative, Southern Baptist Christian. So now what do you do with that? Because that youth group is shrinking and then they're spending less dollars to bring out the Christian version of whoever. So it's like I said, this whoever can figure this out in this space, it's gonna be great. It's not doom and gloom, it's just opportunities, you know what I mean?
Most of my kin, dead of the pen. That's why I'm an Eskimo. I bought an igloo and put on my wrist. Ran out of option, we gotta survive, so we taking risks. Commit a sin, we gotta live, it is what it is. Red dot on your white tee, it look like Japan. The 40 is on me, and if I get high, they blow like a fan. They talk about the hood like they know the answer, but never been in. Commit a sin, we gotta live, it is what it is.
That was Derek Miner. Make sure to go pre-order his album The Trap. It'll release August 10th.
I'm a fan of Derek Minor, but I'm going to say, don't do it. It's a trap. He's literally telling you.
He's literally saying,
sounds like a trap.
This is the trap.
Gonna take the credit card. I don't know. It sounds like a trap. He's being literal. Don't pre-order it. It is a trap.
Listening to Blood Orange, the new single Charcoal Baby. Well, a little behind the scenes here, you guys need to know our very own Annie F. Downs. You know, she's very in demand. She's real hot right now. And she had places to go, people to see, and she had to step away from this last segment of the
show. She's right now, she is on stage preaching a really good Stephen Furtick sermon, bringing the house down.
So Annie will not be joining us for this segment, but through the miracle of technology, when we all close the show, you might just hear a surprise. So anyway, it's time for our listener of the week.
You listen to the show and it's time to get to know you. It's the listener of the week.
Well, this week, our listener of the week is Kenny Reinbold. Welcome to the show, Kenny.
Thank you.
Kenny, where are you calling us from?
I am in Oklahoma City.
There you go. Well, what do you do there in Oklahoma City professionally?
I work for a staffing company in Oklahoma City. I work in the marketing department. So we're a franchise staffing company. We've got offices all across North America. And so I work for our headquarters doing marketing.
So you are at work right now because this is the middle of the workday. Are you on your lunch break?
I am at work, sort of on a lunch break. I'm about to take a lunch break after I get done with you guys. Yeah.
Nice.
So are you on the clock right now? Because, you know, integrity is what you do when nobody's looking.
Well, I got the okay from my manager.
All the marketing exposure he just got for his company. He's playing it smart. You should take the rest of the afternoon off, Kenny. I like the cut of your jib, sir. Kenny, I got a question for you, man. Did you listen to the podcast last week?
I did. I feel like I don't know that I can live up to the Dennis Rodman sized expectations.
Do you know the amount of pressure that is resting on your shoulders right now?
I do. I don't know that I can handle it. I'll try though.
All right. So Jesse, when you saw Kenny's three facts, they caught your eye for a reason. Yeah. So why don't you tell us what Kenny Reinbold's three facts are?
All right, Kenny, let's start with this one. You got into a shoving league match at a minor league baseball with a minor league baseball mascot while dressed as a YMCA mascot. First off, I had no idea the YMCA had a mascot. Was it? Please tell me their mascot is like five people doing the Village People. Because if those five dudes showed up, they're like, oh, this is obviously something for the YMCA. Is that what the YMCA mascot is?
No, it is literally just a giant Y with two arms and two feet.
Okay.
They can do better than that.
Budget or what? But
hey, well, Kenny, let me ask you this. When you ran onto the field dressed as the giant Y, did the YMCA song play?
Well, it didn't play, but I wasn't on a field. I was actually at a health and wellness in downtown Oklahoma City, taking pictures, hanging out with kids. It's pretty easy for the most part. It's hard to see being a mascot, and there wasn't a lot of movement available with my arms and legs in this giant Y. But this minor league baseball team that we have here in Oklahoma City, at the time they were called the Red Hawks. They had a mascot that was a Red Hawk, so it was a bird. And I don't know if it was a guy or a girl or what, but they came over and we were taking pictures with kids. The kids were real excited. And all of a sudden this bird, I don't know if I did something to offend the mascot or what, but it kind of shoved me away from the kids that were wanting to take pictures with us. And
yeah, maybe he was jealous.
I moved up thinking, well, maybe it was just on accident. And they shoved me again. And so this was before I got saved. So obviously I may not have done this, after Christ came into my life, but, I shoved him back and we got into a little pushing match and I didn't have great balance. I didn't fall over, but I couldn't take him on because I didn't have a lot of vision or motion with this mascot.
Okay. So you were humiliated by Red Hawk at this minor league event. Yes. At your wedding ceremony though, there was a flash mob. How were you aware that this was going to happen? What's the story here?
Yeah, I was not. My wife is a musical theater actress, and a few months before we got married, she was in a production of All Shook Up, which is a musical that is only Elvis Presley songs. Okay. And so at our wedding, she knows I grew up listening to music by Elvis. And so at one point during our ceremony, it was I think it was the prayer after we'd exchanged vows, kind of the time where everybody's just hanging out and we're just looking at each other. And all of a sudden, there was one person that got up from my side of, you know, like the groom side of the church and started singing, Can't Help Falling in Love with You. And then another person popped up and then another person popped up. And then eventually she had worked with people that she was in this musical with and plotted them around the sanctuary. And there were probably 10 or 15 people that just started singing Can't Help Falling in Love with You during the ceremony. And I was completely surprised. And so, yeah, it was really cool. It was like a little flash mob.
That's really sweet. That's a really nice. You should have done.
You should have said, stop this. Stop this now. I didn't know about this. This is my wedding. And kick the flash mobbers out. That's what you should have done. And
I probably should have.
I think they would appreciate. I think your wife would have appreciated the, you know, real sense of power that she saw right there. Just a huge maniac.
I'm sure. Yeah, it was a 70 for future success.
Everyone would have been impressed. You missed a real opportunity to get some dignity back after being bested by a guy in a hawk costume, Kenny. You know, I mean, I'm putting some pieces here, but finally. I hope this one, Kenny, you know, this is an opportunity for you to stand up against a wild beast too. Your foot was stepped on by a horse at a Dan Quayle event. I didn't know Dan Quayle was still having events. You could have said Dan Quayle event and I would just been like, oh, that's a pretty good, that's a great story. Dan Quayle's having events right now. That's a thing. Just it's Dan Quayle event. Oh, cool. That's not a story, but just Dan Quayle events. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, but there was a Dan Quayle event some reason a police horse was at and you got close enough that stepped on your foot. What happened? What was this event about?
Yeah. So I was, it was probably when I was 5 or 6, it would have been around the time that he would have been campaigning with the first President Bush. I was living in HW. Just outside of Sacramento, California at the time. And my family wanted to go, he was making a campaign stop. And so they wanted to go see him speak. And I remember being outside and I don't know why this police horse was so close to the crowd or what. Maybe it just wandered up near me. I'm not sure. But I remember looking up and thinking how just massive this horse looked. Of course, I was 5 or 6. So,
You're a 5 or 6 and you're out in the heart of leftist California Hollywood, down the highway at a Dan Quayle event.
Yeah. And so, this horse comes up. I remember petting it and thinking it was really cool. And then I don't know if it got spooked or what happened, but it turned and stepped right on my left foot and ripped basically most of my pinky toenail off, a bunch of skin. I had just blood everywhere. And I have honestly been afraid of horses ever since then. I rode on a horse later on, did not enjoy it. It was not a comfortable experience, but yeah. So, a horse stepped on my foot and, I don't know how I didn't break it, but it was certainly painful.
Here's my question. If that happens, can you sue the police department or Dan Quayle? Someone's liable and it's not you. You're a 5-year old.
Yeah. Right.
You know, someone's responsible for that broken toe.
Yeah. I don't know. I wish my family would have pursued it.
You know? Kenny, have you ever been in a hotel room with a celebrity that was changing clothes?
I have not. I'm really sorry. I mean, I'm not sorry for myself, but no, I have not.
Are you? Yeah. Are you an Oklahoma City Thunder fan?
I am. Yeah.
Okay. Good luck. Good luck. Just curious.
Just chit chat. Just good to know. Yeah.
Congrats on Paul George. Good move for you guys.
All right. Well, thanks for thanks for being our listener of the week there, Kenny. Sorry about your foot.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, if you want to be a listener of the week in a future episode, hit us up on Twitter and tell us 3 interesting facts about yourself. And, you know, you can always also do little things to try and get Jesse's attention. If you've, you know, there have been hundreds that have come through, and if we haven't picked you and you really think you got what it takes, retweet it. Like, let us see it again. We haven't, you know,
bring it to the top of the pile.
Yeah. Do that bump thing that people do for emails sometimes, you know?
Per my earlier email.
don't know if you saw this, but okay, just be don't be passive aggressive. Just resend it. Say, please answer this.
Oh man. Well, many thanks to Derek Miner for joining us. Remember, The Trap is available for pre-order now. Jesse's warning you though.
This is a confession. It is a trap. So I would use not your real credit card. That's all I'm saying.
You can also follow
a very good trap.
Derek on Twitter at the Derek Miner. Also remember Phil Wickham's new album, Living Hope, releases today. We played it early in the show. Really like it.
Sure.
Thanks to Squarespace for making the episode possible. You can go to squarespace.com/relevant for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch your site, use the offer code relevant to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Hey, a little housekeeping note before we wrap it. Just updated the job openings page there at Relevant. If you are in sales, especially in sales, check it out. We got some good opportunities here at the old media company.
And people should get the mag, because not only are this the issue right now incredible with Leon Bridges on the cover. You heard from Ethan Hawke, who's in the magazine last week. You'll also get the one that we're sending to the printer very soon, that I think people are also going to be really excited about reading.
The September issue of Relevant is definitely one that we're excited to tell you about. We're going to try and bite our tongues for a couple more weeks. But if you subscribe now over at relevantmagazine.com, there is a great deal going on. Just trust me, an unprecedented price. And if you act quickly, you will get the September issue as part of the subscription.
And I'm going to sweeten the deal right here. 3 links to 3 incredible Craig Groeschel sermons. Going to knock your socks off. So we'll sweeten the pot a little.
All right. On that note, we'll wrap it up. I'm Cameron Strang.
I'm Chandler Strang.
I'm Tyler Huckabee.
I'm Jesse Carey.
I'm Annie F. Downs.
Oh, there it is. Did you hear it? Technology.
How do we do it?
We'll see you on Wednesday.
For listening to the Relevant Podcast. If you like what you heard, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. Check out other shows from the Relevant Podcast Network in the podcast section at relevantmagazine.com. And while you're there, browse exclusive podcast merchandise at our online store. Make sure to subscribe to Relevant Magazine. Info is available at relevantmagazine.com/subscribe.
Thank you.
So listen, I was at Craig Groeschel's kids baseball game. Just stick with me here. Something really powerful happened.
Relevant Podcast Network.